Do you ever unplug?
No, I really don't, and I should. I don't, ever.
A few weeks ago, we had this Seattle writer, Ijeoma Oluo, on our show, and Ijeoma is an outspoken and blunt force to be reckoned with online. She writes a lot about race and gender, and I have watched her take on critics over and over on Twitter. And so after we wrapped up our interview, I just asked her about this, whether she ever takes a break.
How would I do that? Because I was actually thinking that last night, because I do this thing where I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning almost every day and I check what's going on social media and then try and go back to sleep.
Wait, what?
I know. It's a weird thing I do. My body like automatically wakes up at 4 a.m.
It's like you're a farmer. You go out, you check on the trolls.
Yeah, exactly.
Make sure they're all sort of well fed and then like try and get a little more shut up before you start your day.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not healthy. And I don't know how to not do it. I think it all feels too urgent.
This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is unplugged. And that is a state of being that, for Ijeoma, is elusive.
I've tried to be like, I'm going to take a mental health break. I can't do it. If anything, it increases my anxiety even more because then I'm worried about what's happening that people aren't hearing about.
You feel a responsibility to engage not only your followers, but also the haters too.
Yeah. I do, which is why I don't really block people unless they're like really, really threatening me. They're seeing what I'm saying. You know, even if they hate it, they're seeing it. But it takes a lot out of you. That's part of the reason why I don't go out. It gets worse when I leave and I walk around Seattle and people recognize me for my tweets and for my writing, because then it's just like my entire world becomes this fight.
Oh, yeah.
That I'm living, which has been weird lately. Like, I can't go to a thing without someone coming up to me and trying to talk to me about, did you see this racist thing? And I'm like, I'm trying to eat dinner, you know? Like, I don't know what unplugging would be like. Even my kids are constantly like, oh, mom's mad at the internet again.
We will be thinking about what it means to be plugged in or to unplug for a grunge icon, a renowned composer, or a Buddhist priest. That's coming up on Sound Effect. Don't go away. Okay, so I want you to listen to something. This is the sound when a balloon pops. Okay, so here is what it sounds like if a balloon were to pop inside of an empty 2-million-gallon water tank at Fort Worden State Park in Port Townsend. Now, that is what you call reverb. In fact, it's still going and going and will keep going for another 30 seconds or so. The guy behind that sound is named Stuart Dempster, and he is a pretty well-known composer and trombonist. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Washington these days, and he's had a long interest in recording music out in unusual places. So when he learned about this empty cistern, he thought, hey, maybe this could be a venue for one heck of an acoustic set, the ultimate unplugged album.
Composer David Mahler, who used to live in Seattle, he now lives in Pittsburgh, had told me about it, and he'd been in it. And when we went to do a workshop there together in 1978, they had decided, well, we can't have people in there. They had cemented it off. So I spent the next 12 years badgering Dan Harpel, for whom the cistern is named, to see if he could help in getting it open. And help he did, and eventually got permissions for people to do work in there. It's sort of like being in a wine cellar without any of the accoutrements. It was cold, damp, and if you set down anything for a little while, it picks up moisture, and you know, paper would become sort of not soggy exactly, but you knew there was a lot of moisture in there. All the walls were dripping. I figured that teenagers and other folks were probably partying in there and throwing beer bottles around and just to listen to the sound and the shattering glass. if you're going to build a chord in the cistern, which has a 45-second reverberation, which is quite amazing, you can build a chord up in any reverberation length by your first note being the loudest and longest and the second one being successively a little bit softer, a little bit shorter, and you can get to several note chords. You play a note and you can release it in such a way, if you do it just right, you can go to play it and it crescendos a little bit and then you diminuendo just slightly to leave the sound, but the cistern will continue crescendoing the note for a little bit. So you really can't tell when the cistern takes over. And there was old metal pieces that I can't imagine where a lot of that would have come from. We use the metal, and it's pretty fun hearing all that stuff reverberated.
What makes it artistically interesting for you and not just a kind of quirk or parlor trick?
You can set up all kinds of harmonies, of course, I think, but probably the main thing is that you feel like you have all this support. It's like a support of a really engaged audience. Something is supporting you, and of course it's your own sound. Sort of like drowning in whipped cream. It was rather a pleasant drowning. Drowning in sound is really something special.
Like it's almost being, you're almost flooded or overwhelmed, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's ambisonic to a degree that it's almost hard to fathom. I like to think of it as spherical because you're just getting sound from all over and you sometimes lose track of what's you and what's the reverberation of you. And it's very, very special. It's really listening and deciding, well, this pitch will work really well here. You can't do a lot of stuff because then it turns into sonic granola pretty quickly. After about 3 days of practicing there, I came out and I realized that I had adjusted to the cistern as being the norm and the rest of the world was seemed more alien than I was expecting.
So what has working in the cistern taught you about listening?
I suppose the most important thing it taught me and the most unusual thing is it taught me to listen to the end of the sound. Most people lose interest when there's still about 15 or 20 seconds of reverberation to listen to. Maybe it's only kind of a pulse that you feel maybe almost more than hear.
Where does the cistern work fall for you? What does it mean to you now, looking back on a long career?
If I had my druthers, I'd probably do nothing else.
Really?
Yeah, but yeah, it's just because it's such a... I'm somewhat into healing music, music as a restorative. I mean, there's many world cultures, there's no separation of art and life, or music and healing, as it were. I can breathe easier, it lowers my blood pressure, I guess. It's comforting. So anyway, I really like being in that restorative music space.
Stuart Dempster is a composer and a professor emeritus at the University of Washington. You can find out more about his music at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Listening to Sound Effect on KPLU, I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is unplugged. So I do occasionally find myself coming to, as if from a blackout, realizing I just spent 90 minutes in some internet rabbit hole or other, or that I just checked my phone like 8 times in 5 minutes. It's enough to make me just want to unplug from everything and just sit in the quiet for a while. It sounds so comforting, so zen. So I thought I'd talk it over with an actual Zen priest at Daibaizan Chobo Zen Temple in Seattle.
Daibaizan means Great Plum Mountain, and every Zen temple is named after a mountain. And Great Plum Mountain for us is the top of Beacon Hill.
Genjo Marinello is the abbot here, and he leads me around the grounds.
So this is our garden, with the central feature, water feature, being this fountain. And it gives a sense of peace, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Inside, we take off our shoes and peek into the inner sanctum, a tiny wood-walled room covered in Japanese mats.
This is the heart of the temple, and it's where I see students one-on-one. We, after a little bit of ritual, try to get to the heart of this matter of life and death by sharing very intimately and pointedly to our own true nature. So this is the heart of the temple.
On the way up to his office, Genjo mentions he loves to look at the stars from his roof, and so I asked him if he'd share some of his pictures. No problem.
I'm getting on my iPad, and I'm using my Wi-Fi here at the temple to access my Facebook account and show you some pictures.
Can you teach me how to be patient while apps open? Because I get very impatient.
Yeah, that's the nice thing about spending 2 hours meditating every day. I seem to have infinite patience.
So, yeah, Genjo Marinello is no cloistered monk. He is as connected as anybody I know. So we talked about the virtues of not unplugging, and he explained how his interest in technology goes way back.
Just as kids would play with making a pretend car or a pretend airplane, I made a pretend computer.
Like out of a box or something?
Made a box with what would be the screen and what would be the keyboard, and I put a portable typewriter in there, and I pretend to type on the screen. This was in the third grade.
Is that something that stayed with you as you became an adult and as you began to develop your professional interests and that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, in order to support my practice in Zen, I needed to do something. And so I did a little bit of everything. I delivered papers to the paper boys. I flew kites on the Pike Hill Climb and was a manager of a kite store. And I started a company called Satori Software, which is still out there. And when it got too big, I divorced myself from it. But no, I've always been into computers, big time.
Do you carry your phone with you in your pocket?
There it is, right there in my pocket. But I always keep it on buzz. I never let it ring. And I only look at it when I want to look at it, not when it wants to look at me.
Okay, let's talk more about that, because I think that is a piece of this that a lot of us have a lot of trouble figuring out. What is the difference between those two things for you?
I can feel the danger of sinking into it. Like, I can feel the danger of being on Facebook too long. That's another thing I think about my Zen practice, is that it grounds me. I get this hour in the morning and an hour in the evening that roots me in the earth. It's like planting your tailbone right into the center of the earth. And then I can be around technology and not get sucked up by it.
How does that accord with Buddhist practice and Buddhist thought?
from the Buddhist perspective, the greatest delusion of all is that we are separate, that we're isolated. And then we get stuck in our own egoistic or nationalistic perspective, and we're sunk. I mean, look what happens to the world when that happens. So if we can realize that we're all interconnected, then we can, I think, lead to a world with a bit more peace and harmony and compassion in it.
How do other Buddhists feel about your relationship with technology? Have you ever gotten kind of pushback or people bewildered by the way that you're able to have what seems like a pretty healthy relationship with this stuff?
Yeah, I think some Buddhists, quote unquote, serious practitioners say, well, you know, you're just wasting your time and you're setting a bad example. And I get a little bit of pushback around that, but not much, because most Zen Buddhist clergy, I would say, is pretty plugged in.
What is something that you have learned or grown from that you have encountered because you are connected?
I'm trying to understand the shadow side or the belly side or the underside of the human condition. It's not just about enlightenment. It's about how convoluted, egocentric, narcissistic, and horrifically sadistic the human condition can be. And I want to understand that better. And I've actually learned a lot from the internet, just how awful we treat animals, how awful we treat the planet, how awful we collectively are making a mess of things. I want to understand that better. And I've been going to places like Rwanda and Auschwitz-Birkenau, and I went to a Native American bearing witness retreat in the middle of South Dakota to understand this underside of how we oppress and torture and take advantage of each other. And after a retreat, everyone who's been into the retreat is on a Facebook page where we're sharing stories about how we've been impacted and what we're doing about it and how we're working to do small steps to change the world. Not because we think we're going to change it, but because we're moved in our own open-heartedness to do something.
Well, I don't know if this is a function of the internet or a function of being connected or something, but I feel like so many of us come into contact so regularly with the dark side of human nature online. And I think a lot of people feel really powerless, or they feel like all I can do is, you know, come up with a hashtag on Twitter and that's going to be my stand against this thing. Is there an aphorism or some kind of counsel that you would give to somebody who feels helpless when they encounter this stuff?
Sit with the helplessness, even sit with the hopelessness, and but be rooted or planted in something beyond yourself. And if you do that, what comes up is some kind of insight or inspiration that we could call loving action. You don't know what that will be, but if you don't put your head in the sand, find a way to plug into something bigger than yourself and then sit in the shadow, you'll have an inspiration or an insight on how to respond in the circumstances in which you find yourself, and then be motivated to do so and have the energy to do so.
That seems like a telling metaphor to plug yourself into something bigger than yourself. That's totally consistent with what you're saying about technology, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is consistent, although technology is at the surface, and what I'm talking about is not at the surface, the opposite of the surface.
So I have a few guilty pleasures on my devices, mostly little dumb games, which I shall not name right now, which I find to be ridiculously addictive and rob me of sleep and probably a lot of brain power. Do you have any of those? Any guilty pleasures?
Yes, I do. And actually, I indulge them every day in my own little addicted ways, but they don't absorb my life. They temper a very primitive part of myself, and I'll stay private about what that is, but it's sort of like a pacifier or something. We all have inner kids inside. One of the things that I do is, especially if I'm feeling stressed, is what does that inner child need? Ask that inner kid.
And that is that's a part of you that you embrace and take care of.
Absolutely, and I try to teach everybody to do the same. It's okay to be quote-unquote selfish in that way, because if you don't take care of that little inner being, it becomes a beast.
Well, I feel a little more equipped to tame my own beast now. So I want to thank you so much again, Joe Marinello, for taking the time to talk with us here at the Zen Buddhist Practice Center. Thanks a lot.
You're most welcome. My pleasure.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and considering we are in the Pacific Northwest, and today's show theme is Unplugged, we might as well name the elephant in the room here.
This is our first record. Most people don't own it.
Yeah, we couldn't make it through the hour without talking about the first thing that I think of when I hear the word unplugged, the iconic Nirvana performance on MTV from 1993.
Need an easy friend, I do, with a bed to land, I do.
2 decades later, that session feels like a cultural watershed. And to talk about it, we hit up Seattle music journalist Charles R. Cross. He covered Nirvana's rise when it was happening, and he's the author of Heavier Than Heaven, a biography of Kurt Cobain, along with several other books on Nirvana. So I asked Cross if it was unusual for a band like Nirvana to do one of those MTV live acoustic sets.
It was completely unusual, and Kurt was terrified of the idea. No one expected Nirvana, frankly one of the loudest, rockinest bands ever, to have a side, a acoustic side, that would be a creative high point. I think everybody thought it would be a disaster, including Kurt Cobain.
So you were covering the music scene here in Seattle at the time. What were you doing, and was this something that you were paying attention to?
Absolutely. I was editor at that point of The Rocket, the local music magazine. We were the first magazine to ever put Nirvana on the cover. We covered their career from ground zero and day one, and Kurt advertised in The Rocket several times looking for drummers. People forget that Dave Grohl was actually the sixth drummer in Nirvana, not the first.
He didn't answer The Rocket ad, did he?
Dave did not. But one of the biggest mistakes of my financial life, certainly given how much the Kurt Cobain sweater from Unplugged recently sold for at auction, was there actually was a point in my life where I was holding a check in my hand that Kurt had filled out for a classified ad. And he was already famous, and the check was for $12. And I had to make a decision at that point. Did I keep that signed check of Kurt Cobain, or did I cash it? And there was also the principle that we didn't want to treat any of the musicians that we covered as if they were somehow special. We were part of their entity. And I cashed that check, and that was a pretty, pretty dumb decision ultimately.
What kind of shape was the band in going into this? You know, what was the dynamic among the members, and where were they in their arc?
They were in poor shape. The band is essentially falling apart. Kurt had gone to the other band members and said, "We're a big deal now, and I want to renegotiate the royalty, not just on songs going forward, but on songs that have already been written and published. And basically, I want a bigger percentage of the money of Nirvana." And this was in many ways the end of Nirvana as people thought of Nirvana. Kurt dies in, you know, 1994, but the truth really was is that Nirvana was essentially over by the end of 1993 anyways.
And when they took the stage in New York, I mean, he was a pretty sick guy at that time.
He was. He was definitely a drug addict. He was struggling that day with withdrawals. You know, the story that a couple people that were involved in the production told me is that Kurt was, you know, throwing up backstage. He was laying down on a sofa. He walked into the venue, no smile, no joke, no nothing. And it was extremely tense time. And there was a significant doubt on whether he would actually be able to take the stage. One of the people at MTV, who's quoted in Heavier Than Heaven, and I guess the Statue of Limitations is long gone, essentially told me that she went and bought illegal drugs for Kurt, benzodiazepams, which help with heroin withdrawal and addiction, that essentially MTV, on their dime, went and bought drugs from a corrupt pharmacist so that Kurt could go on stage and perform.
What were the moments in the beginning of that show where it became apparent what kind of a performance it was going to be?
Well, it was a very tense performance. I think in some ways we look at the whole album and we look at the artistic triumph of what ultimately is that album. And we forget that the first, Kurt does not speak a word to the audience for the first three songs. Nothing is said. It's essentially as if you are at a symphony concert where everyone's afraid to even cough or rattle in their seats. This is not the way you would expect a typical Nirvana performance to be. And it was after, I think, the third song where one of the guys in the Meat Puppets kind of made a joke and Kurt made a joke and the air, everybody breathed. It was as if suddenly, things were easier. There is also behind-the-scenes drama, though, that needs to be noted. MTV thought that if Nirvana did an Unplugged, I mean, they literally thought that Kurt would bring Eddie Vedder on. And it would be Kurt, Eddie Vedder, maybe Chris Cornell and Layne Staley. And they would all hang together and do Temple of the Dog or who knows. But that's what MTV wanted with this. And what Kurt did instead was brought his two friends in the Meat Puppets, a band that no one in the MTV brass had ever even heard of, much more wanted on stage with the biggest commercial band of the day. And they were also unhappy about the set list because Kurt had essentially refused to play his biggest hits, and MTV wanted an acoustic version of Smells Like Teen Spirit. And they played six covers.
Oh no, not me. We never lost control.
And at that point, even the uptight MTV brass executives had to admit they were seeing an absolutely mesmerizing performance.
Well, there was also these interesting little bits of interaction between him and his bandmates that it's kind of hard to interpret coming in this much later. What do you make of those? The little back and forth between him and Grohl and some of that kind of stuff.
Well, there's also the sort of backstage drama here. If you saw Nirvana live in concert, and rarely did you get the sense that Kurt Cobain was the general. Early on, one of the most ironic things, the first few times, you know, Nirvana played in Seattle, nobody thought that Kurt was even the leader of the band because he was so shy on stage. The first show Nirvana ever played in Seattle was only four blocks from where we're sitting in the studio now. And at that show, Kurt didn't say a single word to the audience. And instead, Chris Novoselic, the very gregarious bass player, everybody thought it was Novoselic's band and not Kurt Cobain's. But at Unplugged, the tables have been turned. You are getting Napoleon Kurt. And you are getting Kurt, who clearly is in charge of everything. And in some ways, maybe it's fair to say Unplugged is more Kurt's album than any other Nirvana album because he's directing the performance at every point.
Fuck you all. This is the last song of the evening.
What is it?
This was written by my favorite performer.
Our favorite performer, isn't it?
Where is a song that you really see that come through?
Well, you certainly see it in the Lead Belly song. I mean, that...
The last one.
Yeah, I would cite that not only as the greatest song on Unplug, I think that's the greatest thing Kurt ever did. The performance is not perfect. His voice breaks, and that's what really ultimately makes that song so great, is that you're not hearing a vocal perfect. You're hearing the emotional Kurt Cobain. You're hearing, in some ways, an inner Kurt Cobain.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, when did you sleep last night?
Kurt Cobain did not write "Where Did You Sleep Last Night." You know, he did not write it, but he made that song his own in his performance of it that night.
How did Unplugged go over at the time?
Again, as many stories with Nirvana and Kurt Cobain end up, it was not as big a deal in December of 1993 as it would become in April of 1994.
Yeah, there's something very strange and dissociative looking at it now, knowing what we know now, and knowing that nobody in the room could have really known what was going to happen just a few months later. I mean,
everybody saw it. Everyone in Nirvana knew that this thing was ending. Both the band was ending, and in some ways, Kurt's life was ending. The backstory that no one wants to talk about is that by November 1993, Kurt had already overdosed on drugs a number of times, dozens of times at that point in his life. And the idea that he was even on tour was quite shocking. The concept that this was going to continue, or that this man was going to continue, you know, was already really at play. You know, I had the great honor, but also the horrible onus in some ways of reading Kurt's diaries for the first time truly anybody had read them after he died. And, you know, it was clear to him that he was not going to live a long life. By 1993, by the end of 93, in many ways, Kurt was even winding down in the way he even thought about his life.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the clouds, in the clouds, where the sun don't ever shine. I was shivering.
Charles R. Cross is a music journalist and author in Seattle, and besides Nirvana, he's also written books about Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, and Bruce Springsteen. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwin Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. Our interns are Warren Langford and Casey Hicks. We get web help from Dave Nogueras. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find us on iTunes, subscribe to our podcast, and if you are so moved, rate the show, write a quick review. You can also send feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org. You can find us on Facebook, tweet us at KPLU or at Gabriel Spitzer. So we'll be back next week, kind of. It's going to be a little different next week. We have a special presentation of a project from KPLU's Kyle Stokes. Hey, Kyle.
Hey.
What is this thing?
So it's an audio documentary. I've been working on it for the last year now, and it's about Rainier Beach High School, which is on the south end of Seattle. They've done a lot to really shake up their academic offerings. I spent a lot of time at the school over the last year, and next week, you're going to spend some time at the school.
Wow. Okay, that is going to be coming up in this space next week. Thanks a lot, Kyle.
You bet.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.